And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, and men's and boys' issues. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and it is my privilege today to be able to introduce Caro Llewellyn. Caro is a former director of the Sydney Writers Festival and other large-scale writers' festivals around the world. Caro is also the author of three previous works of non-fiction before her memoir, Diving Into Glass. She is currently a director of Museums Victoria. Caro, welcome to Dads on the Air.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Great to be with you today.
Thank you. Well, Caro, Diving Into Glass is a memoir. Were there particular times in your life when you felt like this?
Actually a really long time to write, Bill, because in the beginning it started out just as really the story about my father, and then strange life matters happened to me, and so the book had to change. So it started out really as a very simple story about telling the story of my father, who was 90% paralyzed, and what it was like to grow up with a father like that, and also just his life story. So that's where it began, and then it took a swift change.
Yes, it did, and we'll get to that. But what drives you to write? Do you find a happiness in getting the words down?
Yes, I think it's really the happiest that I ever am when I'm sitting down in front of a page. It's terrifying as well, of course, because you think, am I going to get this right? Is this a story that anybody is going to care about? But truly, to lose yourself for a day or weeks or months or years, whatever, in writing, I think you have to be a certain kind of a person. I don't think that solitary staring at a page and thinking about words is for everybody by any means. But for me, it's my greatest joy. I love it.
You mentioned just then about how your father was in a wheelchair, and that's certainly an unusual upbringing for most of us to think about. But would you say you had a happy childhood?
You know, I think it was a little bit mixed. There were absolutely moments of great, great happiness and a strong, very strong family. But my parents were under duress. You know, I think back in the 1960s, when we were kids, my parents' marriage wasn't doing so well. And I think that the strain for them living with disability in a time where there was no support for, you know, there was no carers, wheelchairs, everything was manual and everything was tough. So I think that put an enormous pressure on my parents' marriage. And, you know, I think nobody does very well in the depths of an unhappy marriage and a divorce. So there were times when it was tricky and it was hard. But the other thing about my father's disability was that it gave me an opportunity. I had an enormous amount of time with him, which was really just a privilege. I think most kids, their dads were off having jobs and they went to work every day, and my dad's work was at home. So I got to hang out with him a lot, and as a child, you know, he used to read to me every read in the morning and play cards and then had all day together when he was running the art galleries. So they were very happy times, and I feel that was a strange, in a funny way, you know, you would think, wow, how could you find something good in it, having a disabled father? But that was a very big upside for me. We were very close.
And at the same time, I guess you had the usual childhood desire to sort of fit in, to be normal like everybody else. So I guess that put a bit of pressure on you as well.
I think as a young child, no. I think in a way, you know, you just accept what you know. And, you know, as a kid, primary school, it was just, there wasn't peer pressure like that. But certainly when I got to high school, I started to feel that pressure, and I'm not very proud about that. But I always, you know, I used to say that I didn't want Dad to come to things, and he never came to us school parent teacher nights, because I was embarrassed. You know, I didn't want people to know that I had a father who was so disabled and looked so strange. And I think, so as a teenager, you know, I think I succumbed to those pressures from peer group pressures. But before that, no, it was just, you know, he was just my dear old dad.
Well, your father, Richard, was so extraordinary in many, many ways. How would you describe him?
Oh, I think he was a very determined human being. You know, when he was 20 years old when he was told he would never walk again. And he decided at that point that he was not going to just take what everybody told him was the acceptable way for him to live, which was, you know, you just go home and you sit in a darkened room and you feel sorry for yourself. He determined that he would fight, and he would fight the system so that people with disabilities could give to society and be active members of society. And before that, before, you know, the norm was, if you've got a disability, you have nothing to offer. You can't contribute. That's the end. And my father refused that that was how he wanted to live. And he fought very hard for be able to work and be able to contribute to society and fought hard for those rights for other people as well.
And he had that, I would regard as an extraordinary achievement. There he was in an iron lung after suffering from fairly late age polio, and he managed to seduce one of the nurses.
He did. My father was very charming. So he's lying in a contraption, and they don't think they weren't sure that he would ever even survive. And he's lying in this strange contraption, and all that's showing is his head hanging out the end. And he managed to seduce my mother, who was a nurse at the time. And they, you know, eventually he did get out of the iron lung, and they got married and had two children. And then he did it all over again. So he managed to do that again with another woman, and he married again and had two more children. So, yes, my father was a charmer, I think you could say.
And at the same time, I mean, we don't want to make light of some of the frustrations that he had, and you talked about a couple of them. One nearly led to the demise of your brother Hugh when he started heading out towards the street, and your father was, of course, immobilised. There wasn't really much he could do except yell out, was there?
That's right. So this is a story. I think some of these things that happen, some of them are funny and some of them are just a little bit terrifying. And this was a story. So my older brother was about two, and my mother went out and they left my brother in his cot and my father, you know, in the shop that they had at the time. And this was meant to be a childproof cot. It was meant to be an inescapable cot. But my brother was also very determined, and he managed to find a way out of his cot at 2 years old and appeared on the ground, on the floor, at my father's wheelchair. And they were living at the time. The shop was on a very busy main road, and the front door was open to encourage customers to come in. And yet, so of course, my brother sees all of this moving traffic out the front on the, you know, just across the footpath, and he starts heading towards it. And, you know, my father had nothing. He couldn't do anything. He couldn't move. All he could do was try to compel this inquisitive child, barely has language, you know, to sit down on the stoop. And thankfully, my brother was happy just sitting on the step for a little while, and thankfully somebody arrived in the shop and was able to save him from a pretty terrible fate. And so I can imagine my father's terror trying to just stop that happening and seeing what could happen and knowing the possibilities and just being absolutely unable to do anything. I think that would have been probably one of the worst moments.
There have been changes since this time in your father, in your life, in your father's life. I suppose that was the 60s, when
yes,
there really was no provision made for people with disabilities, people in wheelchairs. And I think largely due to the efforts of your father, there have been a number of changes, haven't there?
Yes, my dad took on the mantle for other people like him, and he lobbied very hard. He became an advisor to John Bannon, the then Premier of South Australia, and he fought very hard for legislation and access to buildings so that, you know, there were ramps and that there was a building code for disability so that, you know, you just don't realize that one step can be forbidding for people. So he was a great campaigner. He would not let up. He wanted other people with disabilities to be able to contribute and to be active members of society. So, yeah, he was a force of nature, and you didn't want to get on the wrong side of him. And if he was determined to get something, make something happen, it usually did happen.
And we talked about the relationship earlier between your father and your mother, and it started off in that unusual way. But your mother was an unusual person too, wasn't she?
My mother, yes. My mother was also a trailblazer. You know, I think for her to take on that role with my father during that time was pretty amazing. There's not many people who would sign up for that. So we're all so grateful that she was able to do that and that she saw in my father, she wasn't just caught up in, you know, the appearance of him. She could see that he was a wonderful human being despite all the contractions and despite his disability. And, you know, that was a wonderful thing, a wonderful gift that she, you know, gave to him and now to all of us. But, you know, she went on to become a famous poet and a famous writer, and she's had an extraordinary career of her own.
With these relationships, I mean, they weren't all smooth. Certainly your parents finished up splitting up and getting divorced, and then even your own relationship, you had about a four-year separation from your father, didn't you?
I did. I think, like what often happens with children, they get caught in the middle of these things, and it's very hard for them. And I think that parents in their grief and their suffering through divorces, it's tough. And I think a lot of, I am not the only one, and my brother is not the only one. I'm sure this is what happens to a lot of kids. They get caught in the middle of their parents' anguish, and nobody behaves all that well. So it's tricky.
That depth of that relationship was always there, and you got back, I guess, stronger than ever, which is great that you were able to maintain through that whole period. And then you had to form a relationship with wife number two, didn't you? Again, that's often a strain for children.
Becky, my stepmom, was, you know, my parents first separated when I was six. And so she was a part of my life for a long time. And she's a wonderful, wonderful person, and has been a wonderful stepmother to me and my brother. And we're very close. So that was not a hardship. She was a wonderful stepmom, you know, had a different, very different outlook than my mother. I'm not comparing the two of them, but just to say, you know, I had this great alternative, and Becky was American, so, you know, it was culturally different, and that was a very positive thing. And my father was very happy, and they had two more children, so it was a very positive thing.
And there seems to be a bit of circularity in your life, because you had your son Jack, and then you were put in a somewhat similar situation, because you had to introduce Jack to a new man, which is always traumatic for a parent, isn't it?
Yes, I was. Well, that was also another, you know, that was a very positive story. My husband, I married after, you know, Jack was about, I think he must have been about 8 or 9. And that was, you know, my husband was a wonderful step-parent to Jack, and a really great influence on Jack's life. You know, did a lot of wonderful things that, you know, I wouldn't have been able to do as a single mum, or wouldn't have had the thought or the time to do it. So that was also a positive experience for Jack, I think, to have, a solid male figure in his life and someone who was very invested in his well-being and his care. So,
well, we've been talking up to date about your parents, in particular your father, which is really follows the outline of the book, because it's only really in the back third of the book where you get to talk about your own life. But you had a lot of recklessness in your early life, I think.
Yes, I think that I was very compelled to do a lot of the... I felt as a child, I thought I had this responsibility to have a big adventurous life in a way that my father's polio had, you know, maybe muted down for him. And so it was, you know, you could call it reckless or you could call it adventurous. But the other thing I had was, my father always said to me that he was our fall guy, and that he had taken a karmic hit big enough for me and my brother to live through life in the knowledge that nothing physically would ever come to harm us. And I took that very much to heart. And so I did take a lot of risk, because I felt that I was invincible. My father had told me I was going to be invincible, and I believed him because I believed everything he told me. And so, yes, I had an adventurous life, reckless or adventurous. I've had a wonderful career. I've lived in a number of different countries, and, you know, it's been a great adventure.
And we're speaking today with Caro Llewellyn, who is the author of a memoir called Diving Into Glass. So, Caro, there you were. You'd had this recklessness in your life, but you were fairly settled. You were living in New York. You'd been there, say, about 3 years. And you were very fit. You were running in Central Park, New York.
Central Park, yes.
And perhaps you could tell us what happened then, the surprise you got.
So I was running, and I had had strange things happening. You know, I had some numbness in my legs, but, you know, nothing to... It was on my mind, but it wasn't anything that I was terribly worried about. And so I was running... My legs felt strange, but as I got up the, was running up the northern end of Central Park, and I got halfway up the hill, and it really felt like my legs were, you know, I was running on prosthetic legs. I couldn't feel my feet hitting the pavement, and I just kept running, and I was, I have to say, panic was overcoming me, but I kept thinking, I've just got to assume that my feet are going to end up where they're meant to, and that I can just keep on running and keep and run through this and it will pass. But it didn't pass, and I had a terrible moment in Central Park, and I ended up in hospital and then was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis.
Yes, that's not something you can run through, is it? Like a lot of runners' injuries and pains. But that was about 10 years ago, and I understand there are no predictions about progression of this disease, but have you found ways of overcoming it in the meantime?
Yes, I have. I think, you know, the book is really about coming to... I mean, I didn't take that diagnosis very well. I was very angry for a long time. And so it took me some time to come to a state of peace about that, about my diagnosis. But eventually, yes, I did. And I have... a wonderful career that I'm continue to work, and it's, you know, it's not anything that I would wish on anybody, but certainly, and I'm sure many of your listeners have heard the wonderful Selma Blair, the actress who came out on the red carpet recently, and told everybody that she has multiple sclerosis, and, you know, she refers to it as a snowflake disease, and I had never actually heard that term about multiple sclerosis until Selma said it. And that all is to mean that it's very different from person to person. And, you know, my symptoms can be one thing and somebody else can have a very, very different experience of it. The other thing is that it changes. So, you know, at some point, you know, I had numbness in my legs. At other times I've had other things. Sometimes those things pass, sometimes they don't. So it's a evolving thing that you have to keep adapting to, because things do change. And but yes, I have a wonderful career and I'm living back in Australia. I moved from New York about 18 months ago and I'm living in Melbourne for the first time, and it's great.
Oh, look, that's great, because as you mentioned a bit earlier, with having been through it with your father, I'm sure there were times when you thought, why me? You know, how could this happen to me?
That's right. When my father got sick, you know, at the age of 20, he said, the first thing he said was, wow, well, this is going to be interesting. And then the second thing he said was, why not me? You know, most people would have something like that happen to them and they would say, why me? And he thought, well, it's got to be somebody, so why wouldn't it be me? And I think with that attitude, you go on because you're curious and you are not angry. You are just, you're accepting. And I was exactly the opposite of accepting. I was, like I said, I was angry, and the only thing that I could think of was, why me? It seemed a particularly cruel twist of fate that two people in the same family could have a disease. You know, the doctor stood at the end of my bed in New York, and he said to me, do you live in a house with stairs? And I, at that point, had I been able to, I would have got up and king hit him across the board, but... because I knew what that question meant. Mm. And it meant that I was probably looking at a life in a wheelchair like my father. And that did seem terribly unjust, I have to say.
Yeah. Well, after your diagnosis, you continued a relationship, I suppose, of knowing Philip Roth, who was sort of figures large in all our lives after Portnoy's complaint. That must have been a wonderful experience for you.
Yes, Philip was a very positive experience in my life. He and I met just before my diagnosis, and then he was a wonderful support through it. And in my darkest times, he was always able to make me laugh, tell me very silly jokes. Hard to believe that a man of that stature would just be a rolling joke teller, but he certainly was. And he was just very practical. Philip was extremely practical, unsentimental, and just really helped me to get my head around what was happening. And he had a very simple saying to me, which was very helpful, and I think helpful to everybody, and it's the same for everybody, whether or not you have MS or you have Parkinson's or cancer or you get hit by a bus and your life changes to anybody for those things. And actually, to be honest, all of us, it's today. We have today, and we should make the most of this day, no matter what it is and no matter our situation, because we should tell the people who we love that we love them, and we should live good, positive lives, because you never know when it's all going to be snatched away from you. And that was certainly my takeaway, is that today I'm good. I don't know what tomorrow has. None of us does know what tomorrow has. And so live for this day and make sure that this is a good day.
He was also known for a number of quotes, and there was one that that for some reason I liked, which was he used to say that old age is a massacre. I think I know what he's saying.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, I think it is. That was also, he used to say that, but it was also in one of his books. I think it was in Exit Ghost. That was a line from a book, and it was a line that he said often. And it is. Old age is very tricky, and we don't talk about it a lot in society. Again, it's one of those taboo subjects that nobody discusses. And again, old people are meant to be seen and not heard, and we're not all that respectful. Of course, people had a lot of respect for Philip. That was different. But it's a tough thing. Old age is very tough. And I think both of us, I was dealing with my own massacre with MS, and he with, you know, the toughness of old age.
Well, look, this is all fascinating, Caro. Our special guest today, Karen Llewellyn. But, Karen, we've reached the stage of the program where we ask our guests to pick a song. Would you like to tell us which one you picked and why you picked it?
Yes, I have picked the song by Iggy Pop, A Lust for Life. And I think when I think about my dad, I think he had an incredible lust for life. And I like to think that he passed that on to me. And I've always thought of this song as a little bit of my, you know, my motto, because I think life is for living, and whether you've got a disease like mine or you've got something else that you're struggling with, I think if you have a lust for life, then the days are going to be better.
CTO wear a uniform, a line of government long. I'm worth a million in prizes. Yeah, I'm through with sleeping on the sidewalk. No more beating my brains. No more beating my brains. With the liquor and drugs. With the liquor and drugs. Well, I'm just a modern guy. Of course, I had it in my ear before. Could have a lust for life. Could have a lust for life.
And that was Lust for Life by Iggy Pop, especially chosen for today by our special guest, Caro Llewellyn. Don't forget, we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, and send us an email, and we'll be in touch. If you'd like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. So it just remains for me now to give a very special thank you for taking the time to talk to us today. Caro Llewellyn, thank you very much for being on the program, and we wish you all the best in everything, and particularly with your new memoir, Diving Into Glass.
Well, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for having me on the show today.
Thank you, and we'll be back next week with another program on Dads on the Air.